Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. I'm going to catch you up on the latest greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, first thing I want to do is say Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. Thank you very much for all the hard work that you have done and are continuing to do for our families and our society. All right, well, I've got some interesting articles to talk about some women's influence in motorsports as well as the automotive industry itself. Of course, we'll catch up on what's going on with some of the latest and greatest of the world of racing. IndyCars were yesterday at Indianapolis on the road course. We'll talk about that. NASCAR last weekend at Texas, this weekend there in Kansas. We'll certainly talk about what's going on with gas prices. And, of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. Well, our first article today, the title is called 10 Trailblazing Women in the Automotive Industry That You May Not Know. From blinkers to Bluetooth, did you know that many of the features we use in our cars today were invented by women? Well, Women's History Month occurs every year, and it's actually for the entire month of March. Let's talk about some of the most celebrated women in the automotive industry. We're a little late for March, but we'll certainly do it for Mother's Day, right? Well, 1886, Bertha Benz, yes, that Benz, made history by road tripping. During the time when women are not encouraged to be bold behind the wheels, Bertha became the first person to ever travel 65 miles via motorized carriage, which was no easy feat back then. Annie Rainsford French Bouche. Today, 9 out of 10 adults drive in the United States. That's 243 million people on the road. And women have Annie to thank. She became the first woman in America to earn her driver's license in 1900. Margaret Cox. Well, in 1893, she received a patent for her ingenious solution to everyday problems, running a channel of air through the car from the car's engine, because it simply generates a lot of heat, and sending that back into the cars itself. Today, we simply call this our car heater. Mary Barra made history by becoming the first woman CEO of a major automotive manufacturer. Over the last decade, she has become one of the most influential women and executives ever at General Motors. Hedy Lamarr. While remembering her as a Hollywood actress, Hedy Lamarr's most impactful legacy is something that we use on a daily basis. During World War II, she created a device that blocked enemy ships from interrupting the torpedo's guidance systems through frequency jumping. In other words, Bluetooth. Her groundbreaking innovation saved lives in the 40s and still enables us today by using the hands-free connection between our cars and beyond. Well, Gladys West. Well, we would be lost without her. Literally, she was working at them as a mathematician in the U.S. Naval Weapons Laboratory in 1978 and became the project manager of CSAT, the first orbiting satellite measuring ocean depths. Thanks to her innovation, we have GPS technology, which we use every day in our cars. Well, how about Florence Lawrence, daughter of the Charlotte Brickwood Bridgewood, Florence Lawrence became also a performer and an innovator. In 1913, the esteemed silent actress created the auto signaling arm, which would raise when the brakes were pressed. Even though she never received any patents for her idea, the innovation inspired both brake lights and turn signals that shaped the rules of the roads that we use today. Mary Anderson and Charlotte Bridgewood. In 1903, Mary Anderson first had the idea of a windshield wiper during a snowy trolley ride across New York City. She designed a spring-loaded arm that would wipe across the windshield. This required manual operation. Years later, Charlotte Bridgewood expanded on her idea, and in 1917, the first electrically operated windshield wiper was invented. However, their patents eventually expired due to lack of interest from automakers. If they only knew that. Years later, their technology would be an essential feature of every car today. In 1909, Alice Ramsey, driving a rare Maxwell, caught the attention of the company's sales manager. The car company actually paid Ramsey to drive herself and three of her friends 3,600 miles across America, which was no simple task back in those days. It took a whopping 59 days. She became the first woman to ever drive from coast to coast in the United States. She'd later repeat the trip another 30 times. 91 years after, she became the first woman inaugurated into the Automotive Hall of Fame. So the next time you blast your heater on a cold winter morning or crank up your windshield during a rainstorm, you know, take a beat to remember both these fearless women who changed history and feel inspired by the mark they left on this world. Let's talk about some of the women in motorsports. Now, this is a very brief list. I don't have time to talk about everyone, but the history of women in motorsports. The history of women in motorsports is a rich and involved one, marked by numerous pioneering individuals who have broken barriers and made significant contributions to the world of racing. Here's an overview of some of the women in motorsports through the decades. Well, let's talk about the early pioneers in racing. Camille Ducasse from France, a pioneer in motorsports. She was one of the first women to compete in auto racing and long-distance road racing, including the famous Paris to Berlin race, and that was in 1901. Hélène Nice, she was a French racing driver who achieved success in various motorsports disciplines, including rally and Grand Prix racing. She is known for her performances in the 20s and the 30s. Now, here's one that's near and dear to my heart. These next two ladies are Janet Guthrie, United States in the 70s. Janet Guthrie was the first woman to qualify and compete both in the Indianapolis 500 and the Daytona 500 in the 70s. Her achievements paved the way for future female drivers that you see on the track today. Shirley Cha-Cha Muldowney. Shirley Muldowney is a drag racing legend from the 70s and the 80s, became the first woman to win a National Hot Rod Association event. Her success also helped break the gender gap in motorsports and in drag racing. Michelle Mouton, she was a highly successful race driver in France, and she was the owner of the Peugeot Talbot Sport Team. She competed at the highest levels of rallying. Danica Patrick. Danica Patrick became one of the, and she was the 2000s and 2010s, one of the most well-known racing drivers ever, competing in both IndyCar and NASCAR. She won an IndyCar series race and achieved significant attention in motorsports. Catherine Legg. Well, Catherine Legg has competed in Formula, IndyCar, NASCAR. She's also currently driving on the IMSA circuit. One of her most notable achievements became in 2005 when she became the first woman to secure a North American open wheel victory, winning the Toyota Atlantic Series race in Long Beach. Catherine holds the record as the fastest woman at Indy, qualifying speed of 231 miles per hour. So hopefully Catherine Legg will find success in NASCAR, that she's moved over from there. And this is just a good small sampling of some of the greatest motorsports women drivers in history. Well, from the pages of Hemmings, a little, too little, or just enough? I know, dumb question. Like some of my other dumb reflections, and this is from Mike McNesser, who is the editor of Hemmings. Does anyone really need a passenger car with more than 1,000 horsepower? Every time I look at the 2025 Corvette ZR1, all I can come up with is, really? Well, unless you're Warren Johnson and you're running Pro Stock at the Winter National Circuit 1985, do you really need that much horsepower? Again, I know my car references are pitifully out of touch as I write these old fogiest notions about passenger cars in a print publication. A 20-year-old social media influencer on Twitch live streaming the purchase of his ZR1 Corvette paid entirely with cryptocurrency. And again, I'm so pitifully out of touch that I'm not even sure that a 20-year-old influencer would buy a 1,000-horsepower Corvette. Maybe that ZR1 would be a gift from someone more for my age who thinks the blockchain must be a video rental store, who, like 40 years ago, was in high school printing class. Yes, I took one of those. Learning how to typeset by hand, you know, back when Warren Johnson was going rounds in Pro Stock in an Oldsmobile, no less. But again, back to the question, does anybody really need a passenger car with more than 1,000 horsepower? Sure, someone does. Frankly, I hope Chevrolet builds the 2025 Corvette ZR1 and it puts so many additional shifts at Bowling Green plant that they have to hire extra people. I hope to reintroduce an engine building experience at the Performance Building Center and get swamped by requests from ZR1 buyers. But what about the person? Do they really need a 1,000-horsepower passenger car? Me? I don't even need 300 horsepower in a passenger car, which for me probably seems just about right. Now, years ago, I drove a modified fifth-generation Camaro that dynoed at 850 horsepower. Without any electronic aids, on bone-dry pavement, it was basically like trying to ride a kick-and-go scooter across Lake Erie in January. Touch the pedal, spin the tires. Touch the pedal more, a little more gently this time, spin the tires. Rinse and repeat all the way to the nearest tire dealer. Now, horsepower. Even in smallest doses, well, they're not wasted on me. Need proof? Here's the numbers over some of my horsepower misfires. 5 horsepower, the factor-aided output of the Tecumseh engine powering my homemade secondhand go-kart, which I had when I was 8 years old. My maiden voyage resulted in an out-of-control collision with a few dump truck loads of sand, which my dad had hauled in for the job. Luckily, it was soft, fluffy sand. 8 horsepower, the factor-rated output of a Yamaha Trimotor 125 that I got when I was 13. One summer, it got me grounded 3 times in multiple collisions with friends in their three-wheelers, a couple fractured ribs flipping it over backwards when I rode it to the bottom of the hill that I was attempting to climb. 195 horsepower, the factor-rated output of a 350 V8 and a 1970 Chevrolet C10 pickup truck that I bought for $500 when I was 16. A family friend gave it a makeover with a nice smooth paint job. The last coat was barely dry before I drove it into a Mustang II pulling out into traffic on Main Street. 145 horsepower is the factor-rated output of the 305 V8 1978 Monte Carlo that I used as a winter car when I was 19. It wasn't enough to outrun a Dodge Diplomat police patrol unit, but it was just enough to cause a 2-car accident during the pursuit. 400 horsepower, the factor-rated output of a 6-liter LS2 in 2005, the Corvette I once borrowed from General Motors for a week. It was automatic, and when you stepped on the throttle too hard, it would downshift, make a couple gears, snap sideways like a World of Outlaw sprint cars. This is when I concluded that 300 horsepower was a better amount for me. 26 horsepower, the factory-rated output of my favorite vehicle these days, my riding lawnmower. Sure, it's no 2025 ZR1 Corvette, but it's everything I need. This article is from David LaChance, and it's from Hemmings as well, and it says, "A lesson in letting sleeping cars lie." Well, the other day, they are finally tearing down the dilapidated mill building that's not far where we used to live. The demolition has been coming for some time, since a heavy snowfall caused the roof to collapse in 2011, leaving only a brick exterior walls still standing. Now, why my interest in this old mill building? Well, because aside of its historical and architectural significance, it's the place where a few years earlier, I almost became a Porsche owner. The sprawling mill building was an old cotton mill, as many as you would see around New England towns. After the cotton business ended, it was used for a variety of other things, including large-scale mushroom farming. In the early 2000s, it had been bought by someone who had a vision of turning it into a retail space and artist lofts. But in the meantime, it was rented out for storage space for vehicles. Well, that's when I first laid eyes on the Porsche that would become almost mine. I was an uninvited guest, basically a trespasser, if you get. I had gone through the mill on an artist holiday, walked around, and I couldn't resist sneaking behind the sheets of the translucent plastic that marked the borders of the makeshift gallery for the event I was attending that day. The electricity was off, but there was enough light coming through the grimy windows for me to see there was a group of vehicles, boats on trailers, late model cars, things like that. But over in the far corner, there was a shape that called to me. It was a Porsche 924, blanketed under a decade's worth of dust. The 924 wasn't a turbo or a 924S. It was just a plain old 924. Built before Porsche engineers had swapped out better machinery on the rear drums, the four-lug wheels, the dogleg 5-speed transaxle, and the Volkswagen-derived 4-cylinder engine. It was damp in this corner of the mill. Rust showed through some of the chips on the Mexico beige paint. It appeared to be someone had backed it into a pull on one of its perilous indoor driving adventures. The interior was brown vinyl, and there was contrasting patches of mold or maybe mildew. And there was some mold on the steering wheel and the shifter knob, too. and someone had snapped off the hood release lever, preventing an inspection of the engine bay, which was probably best for me. So to sum up, what I had been looking at was the least coveted products to ever wear the Porsche crest, painted in a yawn-inducing color, abused, apparently abandoned, and there was no key in the ignition, and I was sure it had been years since it had run or even moved under its own power. Oh yeah, and the rear bumper was, yeah, banged in. Now, of course, I was wondering why was the Porsche here for sale? I found the owner of the mill who told me it had been left by someone who had run up a rental car bill with which was greater than the minimal value of the car. Would I like to make an offer? Any offer at all? Oh boy, now I was in trouble. The last thing I needed was another project car taking up space and time in my garage. But I hated the idea of letting this worthy old survivor just kind of fade away. Thinking quickly, I became some way to get out of the trap I had laid for myself. I'll make a ridiculously low-ball offer. Then he'd laugh and say no, and that would be the last of it. Well, imagine my surprise when he accepted my $200 offer. Is it possible to suffer buyer's remorse before the money's even exchanged hands? I made a handshake deal for the car, and I wasn't so sure that I wanted it. And it seemed the story was going to end with a flatbed truck depositing this decrepit 924 Porsche into my garage. Well, things didn't go that way. Several weeks went by while the mill owner apparently got preoccupied with more important things than a $200 car, putting off filing the paperwork for the transfer of the title. At last, he told me that there was one hurdle remaining. He had to check with his business partner to see if it was okay selling the Porsche. It turns out we never really had a deal. He said he'd have an answer for me the next day, but several days went by with no phone calls. I dropped by the office to pick up my uncashed check from the apologetic office manager. It was a 60-40 mixture of relief and disappointment as I tore the check up into little pieces and tossed them into the wastebasket. The roof falling in was just the door slamming shut on an ill-conceived idea. But the optimist in me still hopes that some hero came along to rescue that 924, and that person is driving the car today. We'll talk a little NASCAR news from last weekend, and the headline reads, Logano bounces back with caution-riddled Texas overtime victory. Well, Joey Logano prevailed in overtime last Sunday at Texas Motor Speedway to put a win on the board as he defends his NASCAR Cup Series crown. Logano beat Ross Chastain and his Penske teammate Ryan Blaney in the Worth 400. He cleared Blaney on the final restart and drove away. Now, this victory comes just a week after Logano and his number 22 team were disqualified at Talladega Super Speedway for missing a nut on a spoiler bolt. It wiped out their first top five finish of the season. But in Sunday's win, Logano rewrote the statistic by claiming his first win and his first top five of the season. Quote, "The sport changes so quickly," Logano said. "It's crazy how you can ride these roller coasters. I'm so proud of this team, and I'm proud to finally get AAA insurance into Victory Lane. They've been a partner of mine since I've been with Penske, so 13, 14 years, and we had yet to get them in Victory Circle. We had done this tonight, and that was fun." So Joey Logano goes from getting disqualified the week before to winning the Texas race. So Joey Logano wins, Ross Chastain in second, Ryan Blaney in third, Kyle Larson is in fourth, and Eric Jones finishes in fifth. Well, local driver Michael McDowell was leading with less than five laps to go, had some issues, got shuffled back, and ended up crashing two laps before the end of the race and finishes back in 26th position. So Michael McDowell had a shot at the win, but just didn't get it done. We'll talk about NASCAR. NASCAR is today from Kansas, and that race starts at noon on Fox Sports 1. And Kyle Larson is on the pole in his Hendrick Chevrolet. Chris Buescher is going to be starting in second. Christopher Bell in third. Tyler Reddick in fourth. Joey Logano, who won the race last weekend, is starting in fifth. Ty Gibbs in sixth. William Byron in seventh. Daniel Suarez starts eighth. Chase Elliott ninth. And Ryan Blaney will start in 10th position. And that race will be starting on Fox Sports 1 right after the car show. Well, yesterday the IndyCars kicked off the month of May at the Indy Road Course. And the headline reads, Palau, domination in Indy GP. only after a strong fight. Well, 4 wins in 5 races, 5 straight triumphs for a Honda, a championship lead extended to from 60 to 97 points, and nearly 2 full races of an advantage heading into the Indianapolis 500. Alex Palou and Chip Ganassi Racing have done it again. Quote, I can't describe the amazing season we've had so far. I owe everything to the team, everyone working behind the scenes to make me look so fast, Palou said after taking his 3rd straight win at the Indianapolis Grand Prix. But the number 10 Honda team's success on Saturday afternoon wasn't easy, or was it a dull situation as he aced so far in 2025? It was actually looking like Graham Rahal's day, as he jumped the pole sitter on the start to take the lead for 48 straight laps. It was just his first victory, and he was looking for his first victory in 7 years, 11 months, and 6 days. It seemed possible, but then Deja Vu took control of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway road course, and Palou and his strategist Barry Wanzer deployed their winning tire usage plan from Thermal Club to conquer Rahal and the rest of the field. Yeah, I watched the race, and it was really interesting to watch Graham Rahal, who hasn't won in, gosh, some 7 odd years, and he was running so strong, but he was using his tires up, and it was on a different tire strategy, and it just didn't seem to be it was going to last long, and it didn't. So Alex Palou wins the race. Pato O'Ward finishes in 2nd. Will Power in 3rd. Scott McLaughlin in 4th, Scott Dixon in 5th, Graham Rahal ended up finishing in 6th, Marcus Armstrong in 7th, Kyle Kirkwood in 8th, Rinus Vike had a strong run in 9th, and rounding out the top 10 is Felix Rosenquist. The next stop for these guys will be the Indianapolis 500, which I'm looking forward to in a couple weeks. Well, time for some weird and unusual automotive news, and the headline says, a done runner driver drops off his Jeep for repairs but returns to find the shop empty and his car gone. Well, trusting customers will drop their cars off for repair, but they returned with their money, and the man said his car had vanished. Carlos Mires, alleged scammer, had reportedly scammed people out of $40,000 in cash and cars, according to Houston police. He's been arrested and charged with felony theft and expected to appear in Houston court. One alleged victim, Juan Augusto, said it was a huge scam and he knew what he was doing. He claims he dropped his Jeep off at the shop on Chippewa Boulevard in Houston, paid him up front. Over the next few months, claimed to have getting the runaround about what's going on with the car. He showed up and the shop was empty and the Jeep was gone. And then to add insult to injury, he later learned that his car was illegally sold to someone else in Wharton, Texas. Immediately called the sheriff and got a tip that Mears was being charged with felony theft, and he got his Jeep returned. So the key to this story is always know who you're dropping your car off to and make sure you have a trusted source for auto repair. Well, it's time to talk gas price with our friends over at AAA. Right now, the average gas price in the United States is $3.13 a gallon. Here in Arizona, it's $3.29. In New Mexico, it's $2.80. Colorado, $3.12. Utah, $3.27. Nevada, $3.93. And California, wow, $4.88 a gallon. All right, let's see what's going on with our local gas prices here in Arizona. Well, right now, the cheapest gas in the state, you're going to have to head to Sierra Vista down south, $2.45 a gallon. At the Circle K's, $3.47 at the 76 station. The Air Force Base, if you happen to be able to get on base there, $2.54 for gasoline. And let's take a look. Well, looks like all the cheap gas is in Sierra Vista. Everything on this top 10 list is all down there. All right, let's talk about gas prices here in the metro. Well, we have gotten under $3 a gallon, $2.92 at Sam's Club on West Bell Road, the Costco on Waddell Road in Surprise at $2.94, Sam's Club on West Bell Road, the second location at $2.94. Yeah, all the top ones are in Costco's and Sam's Club across town. So hopefully you have a membership for one of those. If not, if you can find gas under $3.15, I would certainly say that's a good deal. Well, we've reached that time. It's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I have a 2016 Hyundai Sonata Limited with a 2.4-liter engine that has about 96,000 miles on it. The dealer is telling me that I need a $250 GDI service every 15,000 miles, When I look at the Hyundai service requirements online, it doesn't recommend this service for either normal or severe usage. Is this really necessary? It doesn't help that my trust level is also at an all-time low when I said I needed new Iridium spark plugs that I had just replaced 2,000 miles ago. Thanks, and that's from Pam. Question, is there a large boat parked behind this dealership, Pam? Sounds like there might be a payment due. Now, if we take the kindest interpretation of attempting to sell you more spark plugs, it's possible that they saw your mileage reading and didn't check the plugs themselves to see if they looked brand new or check their own service records if you had actually had them replaced there. 100,000 miles is about the right time for new spark plugs these days, so you were right to have them replaced. But you shouldn't need a new spark plugs again for another 100,000 miles, so you can cross that one off your list. Now, GDI stands for Gasoline Direct Injection. The service is a service for cleaning the fuel injection system, and it's unlikely you need that either, Pam. It's a very expensive machine that we had at our shop called the Motor Vac. Our customers used to call it the Wallet Vac, because back in the day, when fuel systems cleanings were necessary, the machine got a lot of use. And legitimately so. There were varnishes and deposits that built up in the fuel injection system over the years and would eventually reduce the performance of the fuel injectors. But the Wallet Vac has been gathering dust in the corner of our shop for, let's say, the past 15 years. In fact, the Smithsonian keeps calling us to ask us about it and if we're willing to sell it so they can put it into service at the museum. Now, what's happened over the last 15 years? Fuels have gotten much cleaner. They use detergents that have effectively prevented any varnish or deposits from ever building up in your fuel injectors. As a result, we almost never, ever have to clean fuel injectors anymore. So unless you're having some kind of performance issue that the dealership specifically attributes to dirty fuel injectors, you should pass on that GDI service as well. Now, if you've lost faith in these guys, you can try another better rated dealer if there is one nearby. Or you can go to www.mechanicsfiles.com and search by zip code for a highly recommended and independent mechanic who works on Hyundais. You guys, I can't tell you how many different times I've heard people trying to get sold this GDI service at the dealerships, even though these guys know that the fuel is much better and most likely that doesn't need this service, but they're certainly willing to sell it to you at any rate. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. My name is Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.